Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Tammy Freeman, and I'm joined today by Margaret Harris and Hamish Johnson.
Hi.
Hi.
So later today, we will be announcing the Physics World Breakthrough of the Year for 2019. So this is an award that's given to research that provides a significant advance in knowledge or understanding, is important for scientific progress or developing a real-world application, and is of general interest to the Physics World readers. Now, we've already announced the 10 finalists for this year, which you can read about on the website. And in last week's podcast, we discussed the first five studies on the shortlist in chronological order of when we covered them. So to whet your appetite for the big reveal later today, we'll now take a look at the other five finalists in the running for the award. First up is a team from the University of California, Berkeley, who were the first to trap tiny objects using the Casimir effect. So Hamish, what is the Casimir effect, and how did the researchers use it to hold and manipulate objects?
Well, the Casimir force is a quantum mechanical effect that normally creates an attractive force between two uncharged objects that are very close together. And when I say very close together, you know, this is sort of nano scale force. And this is a real force, and it can actually be a problem for people who make tiny machines because it can cause components to stick together. This is something that's called stiction.
Okay.
And it's a real problem for people who are designing nano machines. And it's a result of the virtual photons that appear and disappear in the space around the objects. So that's what causes the force. And, you know, we've known about the Casimir force, I think, since the 1940s, when Casimir actually proposed it. But about 10 years ago, physicists discovered that the Casimir force can also be repulsive. So you can have an attractive Casimir force and a repulsive Casimir force. And you get this repulsive Casimir force if the objects are immersed in a fluid that has the appropriate optical properties. So I don't think it happens, you know, in air, but if you're using a fluid, you can get this this repulsive force. And a decade ago, some physicists proposed that you could actually create systems where you have a combination of repulsive and attractive Casimir forces. And if you got the balance right, you could use it to trap tiny objects. And so now, that's exactly what Xiang Zhang of the University of California, Berkeley, and colleagues have done. So they've suspended a tiny gold flake above a Teflon-coated gold plate. And they've done this by immersing the entire system in ethanol. So I suppose the ethanol is the liquid that has the right optical properties. And they've done this because the Casimir force between the gold flake and the gold plate is the normal attractive Casimir force. But the force between the gold flake and the Teflon coating is repulsive. And so if they get the thickness of the coating just right, they have both a repulsive and an attractive force, and that will sort of hold the gold flake in place, balancing out the forces. And Zhang believes that this effect, it could be used in fine-tuning the Casimir force in tiny machines, and that could also be used to avoid stiction.
Okay, great. So it's got a potential real-world application.
Yeah, it seems to. I mean, the application that I thought of, but I don't think the authors in the paper that described this work mention it. So maybe it's, you know, maybe
take
I'm
it with
just
a grain of salt.
Yeah. Maybe I'm just fantasizing about this, but I thought, you know, it could be practical in general for holding objects. You know, in a way, it's you can hold something without any input of energy.
Yeah.
And that could be very useful if you're, you know, sort of probing materials. And actually, one of the sort of tour de force moments in this research was actually measuring this trapping. Actually working out that the gold flake was trapped in the first place.
Right.
Because that, you know, it was so tiny.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, some really interesting work using the Casimir effect, and everybody loves the Casimir effect. So
indeed.
I think it definitely deserves to be in our top 10.
Absolutely.
Excellent. So next up is a collaboration called Q+.
I think that's how they pronounce it. Yes. Q+. We'll go with Q+.
Okay. That stands for Quantum Interferometry and Gravitation with Positrons and Lasers. So this group performed the first ever double slit-like experiment, but using antimatter. Margaret, how on earth did they manage to do that?
Well, the simple answer to that is that they took a beam of antimatter and they put it through a diffraction grating. So, you know, that matter works just like antimatter, so that's what they did. A bit more background. The standard double slit experiment is where you fire a beam of particles at two slits in a screen. So the classical result of doing this, which you would get if you were firing ping pong balls or something, is that if you set up a detector behind the slits, all the ping pong balls should arrive either behind the left-hand slit or the right-hand slit with basically nothing in between. What you get when you use quantum particles instead is that you see an interference pattern with peaks and troughs that are spread across the detector with a spacing that depends on the particle's energy. That's because quantum particles are also waves. This is the famous wave-particle duality of quantum mechanics. So this group, they're based in two towns in Italy and also in Switzerland. This group's setup was a little bit more complicated. What they did is they put a beam of positrons, which are positive electrons, through an arrangement of optics called a Talbot-Lau interferometer, and this in effect magnifies the interference pattern, so it's easier to detect. So obviously, I say they put a beam of positrons. Well, you do need a beam of positrons, which are not exactly growing on trees. And I gather their detection system was pretty complex too. And the researchers also needed to produce positrons at several different energies to show that the interference pattern did change as a function of energy, which is predicted by quantum mechanics and violates classical rules. So this is important, I think, because the key thing about antimatter is that, as I said earlier, as far as we've been able to tell, it behaves just like matter except with this opposite charge. And that's actually a problem, because if matter and antimatter really do behave exactly the same, then it's really hard to explain why the universe has so much matter and so little antimatter. They really ought to have been produced in equal amounts in the early universe and then annihilated, so we'd have nothing. But instead, we have matter, lots of it, and basically no antimatter. So if we can find anything, really anything at all, that's different in the way antimatter behaves, that would be huge. And this team in Como, Milan, and Bern, Switzerland, didn't find that, but they did explore a new area, which is how antimatter behaves in a double slit experiment, which is a great place to start when you're looking for these effects.
Absolutely. Do you know what they're looking for next? Have they got any more ideas?
Yeah, so this result actually harkens back to Physics World Breakthrough the year in 2010, which was given to two experimental teams at CERN who developed new ways of controlling neutral antimatter, which is in their case anti-hydrogen atoms. Now, the team in Como, Milan, Bern want to do something similar next, not with anti-hydrogen, but with positronium, which is this weird atom-like thing composed of an electron bound to a positron. So yeah, they do want to explore this further, and it just goes to show that once you have the right tools, you can do all sorts of cool experiments with them. It's really exciting.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that was really interesting when we were picking the top 10 is it took us a long time to convince ourselves that this was actually the first time that this had been done with antimatter. I think, you know, I was at least convinced that this had been done before, because of course, you know, a lot of really interesting double slit experiments have been done with, you know, actually rather huge things, you know, huge atoms or even, you know, sort of biological molecules.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as we can tell, this is the first time that it's been done with antimatter, which is, you know, fantastic.
Excellent. So next on the list, we have a study demonstrating so-called quantum supremacy. So here we have researchers at Google AI Quantum and several other US institutes and universities, and they've used a quantum computer to perform a calculation in a much shorter time than a conventional supercomputer can achieve. So, Hamish, exactly how much faster was the quantum computer?
Well, it was the initial claim.
That's a good question.
Yeah, that's actually central to this work. The calculation took 200 seconds to do on the Google quantum computer.
Okay.
And they used a quantum computer that comprised 53 programmable superconducting quantum bits. And they essentially did a calculation that is the output of a randomly chosen quantum circuit. And you might think, why would anybody want to do such a calculation? Well, apparently it's a completely useless calculation, but it is a very good way of testing your quantum computer.
All right.
Because this happens to be a calculation that quantum computers are very good at doing. And so it took them 200 seconds to do the calculation. And then they sat down and they did an estimate of how long it would take to do on a state-of-the-art supercomputer.
Classical supercomputer.
Classical supercomputer, that's right. So, you know, the sort of thing that you'd have in a government lab somewhere or in the basement at a university. And they reckoned it was 10,000 years.
So, okay.
So, you know, that is a long time. And so the idea here is that would be completely impractical, because how could you do a calculation for 10,000 years on a supercomputer? And so their claim is that this is an example of a problem that only a quantum computer can solve, because you'd never get it solved with a classical counterpart. And that was great. You know, I think a preprint went out by mistake, actually. Everybody was talking about it. And then eventually a paper was published in Nature a few months later. But then something very interesting happened. Around the time that the Nature paper was published, a rival group, well, I don't know if they're a rival group, but another group of quantum computing experts at IBM questioned that 10,000 year claim. And they said that if you sort of worked out a good way of using memory on a conventional supercomputer, you could do the calculation in 2.5 days.
Okay. That's
so,
a bit different.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's different than 10,000 years.
It is very different. And of course, that means that it is not impossible to do the calculation on a conventional computer. So, you know,
although it's still quite a lot slower.
It's about 1,000 times faster. Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's about 1,000 times faster. And when you think about it, that's amazing, because their computer only has 53 bits. And you can imagine how many bits and how much memory a supercomputer has. So, you know, I think experts in the quantum computing field are still, you know, positive about this. It still is a significant accomplishment.
Because previously there wasn't any example of something that a quantum computer had been proven to do faster than a conventional supercomputer.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think, I think there might be some trivial examples. But you know, this is
it's a major result.
This is an important result, I think, and so therefore worthy of inclusion, but maybe not as stupendous as
as it first appeared.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So next on the list we have a quantum gravimeter. So this was developed by physicists at the University of California, Berkeley, and it's basically a compact device that uses trapped atoms to measure gravity with high sensitivity. Margaret, can you tell us a bit more about this device and how it works?
Okay, so quantum gravimeters generally rely on the interference pattern that's generated when clouds of atoms, which are, as we know, waves as well as particles, when these clouds of atoms are first vertically separated in space and then allowed to recombine. The vertical separation means that they experience slightly different values of little g, which is the acceleration due to the Earth's gravity. The value of little g varies depending on altitude above the Earth's surface, so you can use a gravimeter as an altimeter to tell the altitude. And little g also varies depending on the local density of the Earth's crust, so its value can tell you something about the structure what's below ground. So gravimeters have been proposed as a means of detecting oil and gas deposits, or buried infrastructure such as pipelines, and there's some potential military uses as well. Think of detecting secret underground bunkers somewhere. So that's the general principle of a quantum gravimeter. Now we get on to what Victoria Shu and her colleagues in Holger Mueller's group actually did. Most quantum gravimeters measure the effects of gravity as the atoms fall through space, under the effects of gravity. What the Berkeley group did instead was to suspend the atoms in an optical trap, which means that the atoms can interact with the gravitational field for what is, in quantum gravimetry terms, an absolutely enormous amount of time, which is 20 seconds. That doesn't sound like a huge amount of time to humans. I'm sure I've been rabbiting on for more than 20 seconds now about it. But if you did it with non-trapped atoms, you'd need them to fall for like half a kilometer to interact with gravity for that long. And nobody's going to be making a vacuum system that's half a kilometer tall. It's just not going to happen.
No.
So what Xu and colleagues have done is to make a really sensitive gravimeter that is also compact and could therefore, in principle, be taken out of the lab and used to do all the cool things I mentioned earlier. And other people in Mueller's group have actually done that with a different, less sensitive gravimeter that does rely on falling atoms. And I think the physicists at a UK company called M-Squared Lasers, I saw their quantum gravimeter in an exhibition a few weeks ago. They've also taken it out in the field and done measurements with it. And I think there may be some others as well. But this instrument at Berkeley could actually outdo them all. And in fact, it represents the next generation of a class of device that's just starting to see commercial use. And that's why it's on our list.
Excellent. So, interestingly, we've got two interferometry experiments on our list. Do you think you could combine the two? Could you use the gravimeter to study antimatter?
That's a really interesting question. I think the superficial answer, I'm guessing, is no, because the Berkeley Gravitational Interferometer Group, they were working with cesium atoms, which are big and fluffy and really easy to cool down with lasers and an optical trap. And nobody's going to be making anti-cesium anytime soon. We've only barely managed to make anti-helium, which has just two antiprotons. Anti-cesium would have, I think, 55 antiprotons and something like 70-some antineutrons. It's just not going to happen. But I don't actually know if enough about the properties of hydrogen, or indeed antihydrogen, to know whether it might be possible to use similar techniques to trap it instead. If I were guessing, I'd say it was possible in principle, but really difficult in practice. But, you know, if any listeners want to correct me on that, be my guest. Our email address is pwld@ioppublishing.org.
It's funny, Margaret, I asked that very question on Friday. I was at an event at the Institute of Physics in London, and I met somebody who works on one of the experiments at CERN, the antimatter experiments at CERN. And so I asked, you know, could you do these sort of bouncing atoms with anti-hydrogen, and he seemed a bit doubtful. I think the problem is that hydrogen in general is very difficult to cool, and you just couldn't get the hydrogen atoms cold enough to actually do the experiments. He didn't say it's impossible, but I think it's probably pretty far down the road as far as I could tell from our conversation.
But I think it's really exciting. I mean, I did my PhD in atom trapping, so it's really exciting for me to see those techniques applied to antimatter in general and used to explore fundamental physics as well as making practical devices. And this whole idea of antimatter and gravity is really interesting to me as a journalist as well, because one of the first stories I was ever paid to write as a student was about a physicist who wanted to find out if antimatter had different gravitational properties from matter. Or, in colloquial terms, if you drop antimatter, does it fall up? Or does it fall down?
And we don't know, do we?
And we don't know. That was 20 years ago.
They are still working on it.
Yeah. But my fingers are very much crossed, because it looks like in just a few years we're going to find out the answer to the question of whether antimatter falls up.
And antimatter falls up, that will definitely be the physics world breakthrough of the year.
That would definitely be the physics world breakthrough of the year if
they
find
this
out.
Space.
That would be amazing.
Okay, so last on our list of finalists is a team of scientists at the University of Nottingham, the University of Oxford, and University College London, who have developed a wearable MEG scanner. Now, MEG, or magnetoencephalography, is used to measure the tiny magnetic fields generated at the scalp by the flow of currents in the brain, and it allows direct imaging of brain activity. The problem with MEG at the moment is traditional systems use an array of cryogenically cooled sensors in a one-size-fits-all helmet. So these are massive systems. They look like giant versions of the old-fashioned hairdryers you'd find in a salon. And apart from being huge, they're also really sensitive to head movement. So to make these devices smaller, the researchers are using optically pumped magnetometers, or OPMs. Now, these are small, lightweight sensors, and they use these to measure the brain's magnetic fields. And these small sensors, they're light enough to be placed on a helmet of some sort that the patient can wear. Now, according to PhD researcher Ryan Hill, who led this latest study, the team's initial prototype was a 3D printed helmet that was quite heavy and quite scary to look at, apparently. So in their most recent work, they've created a version designed around a lightweight, comfortable bike helmet that can be adapted to any head size. And the idea was to create a system that could be easily used with children. So the team, in fact, they used this bike helmet style scanner to analyze brain activity in a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old watching television, a teenager playing computer games, as well as an adult playing a ukulele. And during all of the scans, the participants could just move around and act naturally and sort of not really take much notice of this thing on their head. So, Margaret, I gather you actually got to see this mega device recently at the UK National Quantum Technologies Showcase. So what did you think?
Well, like you, I mean, I'm used to seeing Meg devices being these massive machines and that you have to remain completely still to use, which is the huge issue not only for imaging children who, you know, a two-year-old, you cannot tell a two-year-old to stay still. I've got a niece who's nearly two and she's not staying still for a moment.
They don't, no.
They don't. And the other thing is, there are some patients with certain neurological disorders. They can't stay still, even if they wanted to. So there's real difficulties with doing MEG imaging on them as well. And so this device, that really does look like a bicycle helmet with some sensors sticking out of it, seems like a huge advance on that. And it would potentially bring brain scanning technology, not only make it open to more people, but also make it much cheaper and therefore much more widely available for medical conditions like mild traumatic brain injury and this sort of thing, which can be quite important to see as soon after the injury happens, so you know what extent it is.
Yeah, I actually caught up with Ryan Hill on Friday.
Indeed.
Yeah, I spoke to him after.
He's been around, yeah.
After I spoke to the antimatter guy. And there was an interesting, breakthrough. They showed me the latest helmet and the actual sensors. They've sort of cut the size in half of the sensors. So, you know, they're making real progress, it seems.
Roughly how big are the sensors now? A couple of inches?
Well, the actual sensing bit is about this big. I'm sure people in radio land. If you look at the image of the girl wearing the helmet on the Physics World website, the sensors are now half the size. Bits sticking out of the helmet are half the size. So, you know, they seem to have made real progress. Unfortunately, Ryan there's nobody there playing ukulele, but it was really impressive to see the technology.
So, and you spoke with Ryan and asked him how the sensors work and also what the team plan to do next.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he gave me an update. Here's Ryan Hill.
So I'm Ryan Hill. I'm a PhD researcher at the University of Nottingham. The OPMs work by optically pumping rubidium gas into a certain quantum state that makes them very sensitive to changes in magnetic field. By using a probing laser, we can see the changes in light that's transmitted through the cell, and that gives us an indication on the change of field that's present. For the application of these new sensors with MEG, traditionally we have to use supercooled sensors, which offer many issues in terms of cost and also placement. These new sensors can be put directly on the head, which means that we can now adapt to any head shape and any age. It also allows participants to move while they're being scanned, so this is helpful in doing more naturalistic tasks, also in scanning children who don't like to stay still, and even in conditions such as Parkinson's, where patients are physically unable to stay still. So the next step in the research is to carry on kind of pushing this technology to see what new paradigms we can do, but also finding ways to make it more clinically applicable so that we can really start helping people and really try and understand the brain a lot more by exploiting this new technology to give us better methods.
So you can read more about the 10 finalists on the Physics World website. And make sure you check back later this afternoon when we will announce the winner of the Physics World Breakthrough of the Year for 2019. Then tune into next week's podcast to find out more about the winning research. So thanks to Hamish and Margaret for being with us today. A special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. And finally, if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. And we're also on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.